is Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Dave Wyman and Bob Stelton.
It is Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle. We've been talking very much about what went wrong with the Seahawks, what went right. Still have to get into a lot of situations, but I wanted to talk about the O-line. I said, we got to get Big Ray Roberts on. Who better to discuss O-line play with than the one, the only Ray Roberts, who's with us now? What's going on, man?
Nothing much, dude. Just enjoying the sunsets down here in Kirkland, and I'm excited that you're maybe the only person down there that has come to their senses about me knowing the offensive line.
I don't think that's true at all. I don't think that's true at all.
There's too many. I'm not talking about Dave. Dave knows me. But there's too many other folks that think they know that don't know.
Yeah. Well, I want to get your thoughts because I want to make sure what I think I saw was accurate. And what I felt like I saw in the beginning, first half, and maybe even past the first half of the season, was the best O-line they've had in years. I felt like Russell had more time in the pocket than I can remember in recent memory. First of all, let's just address the first half of the season, maybe a little bit past in the play, because did you see it that way? I thought a lot of the sacks he took were because he just held out. He got so comfortable with the amount of time he had there. He was holding onto the ball too long at times. But first half of the season, give me your thoughts on the O-line play.
Yeah, I was super surprised at how well they came out playing, just because they didn't have an off season to kind of get together and gel together. Didn't have much of a preseason before the games started. And so with all the new pieces, I thought it was going to take them a while to kind of gel. But they kind of came out the gate like gangbusters, and they were playing really well. They were playing good football. They were, you know, like some people may say, like, well, the defenses weren't as great, but they were still playing against, like Dave says, they're still playing against NFL players. And when you looked at, you know, just how they were going about their business, so the techniques and things like that was looking pretty good. The rookie and Shell were, you know, starting to kind of gel and kind of come together on some of their double teams and passing off games and what have you. But I thought that they came out a lot hotter and a lot faster than I would have imagined in the first half of the season.
Yeah, you and me both. And then I would say maybe the last month of the season, and then certainly in the Rams playoff game. And I know the last month they were dealing with injuries. Guys were in and out. Yapati was hurt, and everybody was hurt at one point or another. But then you fast forward to that Rams game, and Ray, I've watched that probably four times now. Nobody had a good day, and in particular, Ethan Posick. And I understand Aaron Donald is a monster, but even when he got knocked out of the game, they were getting destroyed out there. What was your takeaway from that game?
Well, I think from that game in particular, first I'll just say, like, down the stretch, I think the injuries really got to them, and then the offense not really knowing what they were going to be doing from game to game. Like, you know, they'd start the game out and throw the ball, you know, try to throw the ball five or six, seven times in a row, or they'd run the ball. There was a couple games where they never ran the ball twice in a row until, like, the fourth quarter. And so, like, so that kind of takes away some of your effectiveness in the passing game when everyone's starting to play you for these explosive plays that they were used to having. And so when they're playing coverage and you're rushing the quarterback with halfway decent rushers, it's really hard to hold up as a pass rusher, a pass blocker, because you don't have the other, you don't have another tool in your box where they think you're going to run the ball. So I think that the injuries and then that just scenario just kind of impacted their play down the stretch. Against the Rams, I think they kind of got, like sometimes when the champ kind of, the Mike Tyson Douglas fight, mm-hmm. when Douglas finally hit Tyson on the chin and he was just kind of rattled from that point on, I think that happened to the offensive line. I don't think that they expected, I thought they were going to be ready to manage whatever, you know, Aaron Donald was going to bring to the table because they had done it for, you know, basically two games. But I don't think that they were ready for the other guys, not even including Floyd, but the other guys that were playing really well up front. I heard, you know, earlier in that week that I think Brock Stewart had done an interview with Sean McVay, and he said that on offense, on defense, what they try to do is put their guys in a position to never be double teamed. And so because they do that, they have some pretty athletic dudes, and they just kind of outplayed our front up top, especially when You know, we just weren't trying to establish a run. We wasn't kind of real sure what we're doing in the passing game. We're holding on to the ball. And then you put on top of that, that Aaron Donald was getting after the quarterback and Floyd was getting after the quarterback. It just made for just a really bad, it was the perfect storm for the Rams and the worst storm, for the year for the offense.
Ray, you saw the Green Bay Ram playoff game, correct? You watched that game.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that was what was so discouraging to me. What did you see? How was it that Green Bay, first of all, I took pictures on my phone and send them to my coworkers. But you know, I took a picture where every single Los Angeles Ram defensive lineman was turned. Like from the sidelines, you could see their numbers. How did they do that? How did they, you know, get, they had three singles and one double, you know, and were blocking those guys up. And the Seahawks, you know, they had even trouble with the second string line with that Fox guy coming in. And, mm-hmm. you know, they didn't have the mainline guys when Aaron Donald wasn't in there, and they weren't able to do that. What did you see out of Green Bay, I guess, that they were doing that was so different? Or is it talent or what?
No, well, I think, Dave, for one thing, ever since, like, Walter Jones and Steve Hutchinson left, the Rams have just been a bad matchup for the Seahawks offensive line. It doesn't matter if the Seahawks were good or bad up front. They have just always given this team problems up front forever. Like, it has just been that way. Even when the Rams, you know, weren't winning a whole bunch of games, but they had, you know, Aaron Donald on the field and some other guys. They were still... You know, they had Chris Long and a couple other guys. They were still giving the Hawks trouble up front. So sometimes it's just like some people just have your number, man. It's like, you know, I played against like probably all 10 of the top 10 sack leaders in the NFL in my career. And the one dude that gave me the most trouble was Leslie O'Neal. Like, for whatever reason, dude wasn't the fastest, the biggest, or the strongest, but I just had a hard time getting my hands on him. And so I think some of that plays into it. The other part of it is I think the interior linemen, the tackle, the two guards in the center are, you know, if you had to go man for man, I think they're better than what we have in the middle. And I think for this offense to work and for how Green Bay's offense worked, those three guys in the middle went to work. Their center, right guard, left guard went to work. I think Upati is probably, you know, I think he's just too injury riddled. I've seen times where he can get to the linebacker but can't finish the block. You know, maybe that's just because of age or injury or what have you. Simmons isn't quite there yet. And then obviously Damon Lewis is played well for a rookie, but I don't think he was ready for that game in that environment. And then Posick, I think Posick had a good season, but he is going to play as well as the guards beside him play. If they have good solid guard play, then he'll play well because he's not the most powerful dude in the world, but he is a technician. And so he can survive with good guards. So I think, you know, the other thing that the Green Bay did is they made that defense defend the entire field. So they ran edge plays. They ran plays between the tackles. They threw screens. They threw quick game. They threw deep passes. And so you have to – that's what I mean when I say, like, if you start to take those things away, you take the tools of the offensive line away too. You know, and so, like, if you make them defend the entire field – all the way across, you know, from sideline to sideline, end zone to end zone, then you have a better chance that your offensive line being efficient and better, and you have a better chance of them having success, you know, against some of these tougher defensive lines. I remember a few years ago when the Seahawks, I think Michael Bennett was still here, we had some good pass rushers up front, went to play Tennessee when they had Mariota, and we couldn't get to him because he was just getting the ball out of his hand so fast. And it was really frustrating me watching it because I'm like, why can't we get to the quarterback? But if you watch the game, the ball was just coming out so fast that the pass rush couldn't get to him. So things like that help. And so I think the Seahawks are really close up front, but I think they need a good offseason. They need a left guard and maybe a center to compete with Posick.
When we look at the downturn, we talked about, you know, obviously Shoddy being let go, Pete talked about him inserting himself into the offense, dialing it back when the turnovers were happening, and it seemed like they never found their identity after that. How much do you put on the play calling? How much do you put on Russell's play? Because we saw Russell play maybe one of the worst games we've ever seen him play in that Rams game. Right. And then the line had their problems. So you just kind of had this perfect storm of maybe play calling, Pete being involved, line not playing well, Russell not playing well. How do you slice up? We were calling it the blame pie. Who gets the biggest slice of the blame pie, if you will?
You know what? Like, I just look at it, and it's enough for everybody. You know what I'm saying? It doesn't matter, you know, if one person
they get equal slices, huh?
Another person gets 5%. Like, I'm giving the pie to everybody. Like, I'm saying, hey, everybody come around this big pie and take a big bite of it. You know, so, like, the offensive line, I think the play calling. Like, honestly, like, I went back and looked at Chris Carson's, you know, you guys were talking to Bumpus about the running backs earlier, and I looked at Chris Carson's, just, I don't do a whole lot of the next-gen stats, but I just went to ESPN and they do the game splits. Mm-hmm. And every category that they had him for, the day of the week you played on, the down, the quarter, what time of the day it was, home or away, this dude averaged over almost 5 yards a carry or more on every single situation. In the playoff game, he was averaging at the time probably about over 5 yards a carry. But it wasn't – the running game never became something that was part of the offense. And so I think what Pete is saying, not that you necessarily have to go back to Marshawn Lynch and we're going to go 3 yards in a cloud of dust and throw it, you know, 19 or 20 times a game, but I think you have to have the offense, the running game, as part of the offense. And not as an afterthought, or like, hey, well, it's 3rd-and-2. We haven't run the ball in, you know, a quarter and a half. Let's go run it now and get the first down. Like, and so it's just that, to me, was the situation the entire year. If you look at the Green Bay Packers, I think Aaron Rodgers was 25th in the pass attempts per game. But he threw for 50 touchdowns and 4 interceptions, and they had a running back that rushed for almost 1,200 yards. So there's no reason that the Seahawks offense can't look like that. They have the receivers. They have the running backs. If, you know, if Carson comes back or they find another guy, they have the quarterback. They have the pieces of an offensive line that can do that. And so when I hear Pete, I don't hear Pete saying, hey, we got to go back to Marshawn Lynch. What I hear Pete saying is that we have to make them defend the entire field. We have weapons all over the field. We have to game plan our weapons to be successful, all of them, not just Russell and DK and Tyler, but the whole entire offense.
Yeah, it's always mystifying to me when people start to complain about pounding the rock or, you know, the running game. And I've been saying it all week, Ray, that 7 of the top 10 teams in the run, you know, that are successful, the best running teams in the league, every year, 7 of the top 10 make the playoffs. I mean, it's just part of, you know, a good offense. And, you know, so it's crazy to me that people want to say that, oh, that's old-fashioned, whatever. I mean, it works. And it's one of the most indicative, you know, stats that you can have. You can run the ball. It's just nice to know. And then, you know, this, Ray, as a play caller, like even calling in high school, I just remember a couple of times that I got to call it, and I was like, run, run, run. Oh, it feels good to call those runs, man. But,
I'll put it to you this way, Dave, and I said this before on here. When you grow up playing football, you grow up wanting to smash dudes. You want to take their will away. You want to reach into their chest and grab their heart out. You want to make them, like, when they come up to the line of scrimmage, not want to make eye contact with you. You want to drive them so far in the ground that it leaves an imprint, right? So when you take the running game away from an offensive line, you take that part away from them, right? So they don't get to impose their will on a guy that then that guy goes like, you know what? Like, I don't know if I'm up for this today. Like, or maybe I need to go out the game when it's run downs and I can only come in when it's pass downs. Like, you don't, when you just drop back and throw it 40 or 50 times a game, you don't allow the offensive line to get that going. And you also don't allow the running back and offensive line to start filling out how the defense is playing the different runs. Are the linebackers flying over the top on the stretch? Are they kind of hanging back, or, you know, so I can hit it on the front side? If they're flying over the top, I can cut it to the backside. Like, all those different kinds of things. You can't get all of that stuff established if you're just running the ball, like run, pass, and then pass, run. And then all of a sudden you want to rely on the running game in a crucial point of the game. You haven't really established any kind of rhythm to it. And so, to me, you know, having a balanced attack doesn't mean it's 50 runs and 50 passes. It just means that it's a cohesive, comprehensive attack to football. And so that means running the football and giving those dudes up front, you know, like the nowadays, the guys want to rush the quarterback. And what I've learned in my career and what I've seen on TV and stuff is when you have a bunch of dudes that want to rush the quarterback, they don't like it when it gets noisy. They don't like it when they're getting double teamed in run game. They don't like it when you're driving them down, you know, 3 or 4 yards down the field and dumping on their back. They don't like that. I've played against some of the best, and I've seen them tap out in those situations when in Detroit when we got the running game going and stuff like that. So when you take that away from them, you're taking half of their game away. It'd be like, you know, Bob, like you're into the MMA and boxing and stuff. It'd be like trying to do that with one arm or one leg,
mm-hmm.
or taking, you know, having to fight Conor McGregor, and they're telling you, like, you know what, you can fight him, but you don't get to kick him. You just get punched. Like you'd be like, no, that ain't gonna work. I mean, you know, so you're gonna kick my ass, you know. So I get excited, and I get, because I don't think people understand how a lot of that is part of developing your offensive line and developing your offensive linemen. You know, it's a mentality. It's a like, there was a game this year where you know, Dwayne Brown was walking off the field doing an incredible Hulk, like, you know, scream, like, run the ball. It was 3rd and 2, and they ran a boot, and Russell had to throw it out of bounds. And so he was upset. Like, so this offensive line wants to be that. I don't know that they put them in a position to be that this year.
So as far as the talent that's on the line right now, you brought up, I agree with you on Yapati. I just think he's reached the limit of what he can do. I think Posick was really good, and he got exposed a little bit, maybe not as physical as they need there. And then Brown is, I mean, listen, he's not getting younger. I don't think he's a liability or anything at this point, but you have to plan for his replacement. Are any of the guys, whether it's Jamarco Jones, Cedric Oboihe, Simmons, do you feel like any of those guys are an every weekend, game in, game out starter, or do you feel like these are just good, talented backups?
Well, I think Marco Jones has a chance just because he's really athletic, and if he can get, like, a little bit stronger. The one problem I've had sometimes with the offensive line here is that, and I've said this before too, is that they get a lot of dudes that have their degrees in playing offensive line, and they move them all over the place. Versus finding a dude that has a PhD in left guard,
mm-hmm.
or a PhD at center, or a PhD at right guard. Like, they found a PhD in right guard in Damian Lewis. Like, that dude is a right guard. Dwayne Brown has a PhD at left tackle. You know what I'm saying? So instead of finding these dudes, you're moving around, because you never get good at anything. You're just kind of like
jack of all trades, master of none.
Yeah, like, because you're playing right guard one game, center one game, left guard one game, right tackle one game. So it's hard for you to hone in your craft like that. So, but I think I think Jamarco Jones has a chance to be that if they kind of put him somewhere and leave him there. As far as Dwayne is concerned, I think Dwayne has a couple more good years in him, but it's going to take a lot of load management. You know, he's been at it for a long time. He's been good. But I do think they need to start thinking about, you know, who's going to replace him? Who's going to be the next guy up? You know, whether that's a free agent or developing a young guy in the draft, you know, out of the draft, that kind of way. But I like Shell. I like, you know, I think if he had a good year of off season work, you know, in the system, work beside Damian Lewis, I think that can be great. I do think that, you know, like, Posick is only going to be as good as the guards around him, so they don't necessarily have a center that can just kind of be dominant and hold his own. When you play the Rams, they're going to always isolate the center that way, especially, you know, they did that against Posick. And then, like I said, the left guard spot. So I think they have some pieces, and they have some guys they can develop behind them to be good backups. And I think Jamarco Jones has like an outside chance of being a starter, or potentially like a left tackle, because he has the athleticism. He just needs to be put there and left there so that he can develop as one.
You know, I think that's one of the best things that I've heard analysis-wise about a guy who is a PhD at guard, at tackle, or specifically left guard.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the highest compliment I can pay you, Ray, is that it's the same type of thing we heard from the late, great Howard Mudd when we talked to him a couple of times on the radio. Because, you know, I know he disagreed with a little bit with Tom Cable about getting defensive players,
right,
and switching them over. You want guys that have been there their entire, you know, career. And we've placed this premium on guys that are versatile. Like, that's a great thing. This guy can play center, he can play guard and everything. And that's fine. But then when all of a sudden you have to do it, then it becomes kind of a different story. Like, I'm with you on that. I mean, all of a sudden now it's like, oh, well, I need a guy who's been there and seen everything at that position. So yeah, I mean, I think that's something that maybe we've gotten away from, that now in the name of versatility, when maybe it's a bad thing.
Yeah, well, you know, Howard Mudd, you know, God bless him. That dude is, that's where I learned how to be a pro from Howard. I learned how to play football, how to be an offensive lineman when I came to the league. You know, for a guy my size, I was pretty athletic and things, and so I relied on that a lot. And Howard really preached the technique of things and paying attention to the little details and hand placement and foot placement and all this other kind of stuff, and really took my career to another level. So I have a lot of Muddisms in me that will come out, because I think that's just my unconscious way, I guess, of honoring that dude. But yeah, I had a lot of conversations with Howard around the Seahawks offensive line and Tom Cable, and the whole nine. Would sit at his house for hours and we'd talk about it. And so we probably had the same view about Tom Cable. we probably shared that view, but we also shared a view that, you know, it's good to have. When I played, a dude that had a lot of versatility was just a guy that was able to stay around the team for a while, because in case someone got hurt and you need to play, you can do that. But the guys that were starters had PhDs in what they were doing. Like, we didn't have a whole lot of dudes that were going from right guard to left guard to center to tackle, like all that kind of stuff. We had dudes that we had a right guard, we had a left guard, we had a center, right tackle, left tackle. That's what we had. Like, it's like, you know, and you just got good at what you do. And so I really think that, you know, it looks good, it sounds good to be able to say, like, hey, look at this little toy we got, and he can do this and he can do that and all that. But in the long run, you're doing that dude a disservice, and you're also not developing your offensive line in a way that you can have you know, a really efficient to dominant, you know, five that can play.
Hey, before we let you go, Ray, and again, we're speaking with Big Ray Roberts here with Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle. Of the names that you've heard thrown out there for potential as offensive coordinator for this team, do you have a favorite? Is there one? I lost my mind when I heard Adam Gase. anybody else grabbing you out there that you heard that you think realistically could occupy that spot?
Well, you know, to be honest with you, I just have seen names of people that I would not want versus, like, you know, versus the one that you have that, you know, that could possibly be here. I do think Dave had said earlier that the offensive coordinator is out there somewhere, and it could be someone that's off the radar that could come in and, like he was speaking of the defensive coordinator at the Rams, and mm-hmm. then all of a sudden have that type of impact. And so, to me, Russell's at a point in his career that you don't need a guy that's going to come in to develop Russell. You need someone that can come in and build something around Russell and use all of the weapons we have. And so I'd like, you know, even the guy that was one of the head coaches in that American Football League or something. I think it's Pep Hamilton, I think is his name.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, I just like him. Like, he did a lot with a little, and even in that league, and then he's been coaching on one of the staffs. I think maybe the Carolina Panthers, I think. And so somebody like that, that, you know, I think he has enough creativity in him. I think he has enough knowledge that, you know, he's not going to, you know, blow you away as a hire. But I think the guy has the potential to be a dude that can unlock the offense, not unlock Russell, but the entire offense. And so that's who I would put myself – to looking for a guy like that. You know, Adam Gase – I swear to God, I hope that's not true. that just would be, I mean, even the PR of that would be tough, bro. I can't imagine, you know, I just can't imagine it.
Yeah, you and me both, my friend.
What if both Pete and Russ came out of it and said, I'm telling you, this Adam Gase guy, it was like dynamic. It was magical. And Bob said then he would start to question Russell Wilson's sanity. That's
yes.
how far he's going with
yes, yeah. I would.
The anti-Adam Gase stuff.
Yes, I would.
Well, I would question that, and I would question this whole neutrality thing. Like, I'm like, there must be some kind of drugging going on with that. Or something. and maybe Pete has drifted back to the hippie days or something. They were both in a different planet when that interview went down. But, yeah, that would be really surprising to me. And I'll tell you, even with – I understand wanting the quarterbacks, you know, to have some input. But I'm kind of old school this way, man. Like, coaches coach, players play.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? It's like, you call the play, it's my job to execute the play. you know, no matter what you call. And so some people will say, well, this is Russell's future. What is Dwayne Brown's future? Is Damian Lewis's future? Is Tony Ford's future? Is Bobby Wagner's future? So why is it that the quarterback gets to have the input, you know, to it? You know, and so it's just like, I understand why people might say that, oh, he's the CEO of the team and all this other kind of stuff. But it's like, you know, if I want someone that's going to have their eye on what's good for the entire offense, not just what's good for Russell. They're all playmakers. The offensive line are playmakers. The receivers are playmakers. The running backs are playmakers. Quarterback is a playmaker. So we need somebody that can maximize all of that, not just Russell.
He is Big Ray Roberts. You can follow him on Twitter at Big Ray Roberts. So check him out there. And it's been a pleasure, as always, my friend. Thanks so much for cutting out the time, and hopefully we're talking again soon.
Oh, always, man. You know I love jumping on with you guys. And we haven't disagreed on anything in a while, so I think our streak is back on.
Yeah, I think it is. We're back in lockstep with each other, which makes the world happy. We appreciate it, man.
All right, thanks, Ray.
All right, peace.
There you go. Big Ray Roberts talking O-line. Who better to discuss O-line with? Coming up next, how much did the Seahawks turnover differential impact their season? And did Pete make the right decision to dial things back when the giveaways were increasing? We'll talk about that next with Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live through the Alaska Airlines studio on the 710 Sports app.
Now, here are your hosts, Dave Wyman and Bob Stelton.
Just got to let the song kick in there, Dave.
I got you.
It is Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle. Our thanks to Big Ray Roberts. Again, you can follow him on Twitter, at Big Ray Roberts. Always fun to have him on the show. Meanwhile, the question before the break was, how much did the Seahawks turnover differential impact the season? Because I understand it's huge. Turnovers are huge. They did win 12 games. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about this earlier, touching on it. You were sort of talking about, you know, the giveaways each year. And when Pete did, in the other part of this question is, did Pete make the right decision to dial things back when the turnovers started to increase?
Yeah. Did he truly handcuff them? Which, you know, it was kind of,
things changed, whether you call it handcuffing or not. It was clear, and we talked about it every week, and the best way I could describe it was just saying, I feel like they're kind of caught in between who they were at the beginning of the year, this high-flying,
right,
you know, high-scoring, explosive offense that led the league in points scored for 9 weeks versus what they were, which felt like not quite what Pete wanted them to be, but it certainly wasn't what it was at the beginning of the season either.
Right. Well, and there was a four-game streak there that went from at Arizona, where Russ, did he throw three interceptions in that one? Yes, he did, in overtime.
I believe so.
And then, you know, we'll have this discussion about whether it was about the red zone interceptions that were the worst. But it went from that game that they lost in overtime to the game at the Los Angeles Rams. They went -5 in turnover ratio in those four games. And I think they're at that point, they were up to like +7 or something. They finished at +4. But in that four-game streak, San Francisco not really being part of it, but it was, you know, sort of bookended by the Buffalo game, which was horrible. That was the worst game. The worst game was Buffalo. I mean, if you take out the playoff games, regular season, that one felt really bad.
It's weird. The offense put up 34.
I know.
In that game.
But it just...
The defense gave up 44.
But then Russ turned it over a bunch, and it was, yeah. But, I mean, there was 10 total giveaways in those four games. So was it justified, yes or no? You know, I'm not so sure, because here's the thing. The Seahawks gave it up 18 times. Well, that's about their average ever since Pete's been here. So, I mean, and really, it's not that bad of a performance. I mean, obviously, you want to be like 2018. You know, they took the ball away 26 times and only gave up 11, which is really hard to do. But for the most part, what they've been is 14 was good in 2014, then 14 giveaways, 16 giveaways in 2015. But, I mean, this is, you know, pretty much the same number of giveaways that they had the Super Bowl year. They had actually one more, 19. So, yeah, did Pete maybe push the panic button a little bit on that? Or, you know, how much did that truly handcuff Russell. But going through all of the giveaways and takeaways, Bob, the one thing that stood out to me is that the takeaways is where they really, you know, they had like their third worst season since Pete's been here with only 22.
How do you correct that, though?
That's the thing. Well, first of all, as Maura pointed out when we were having the discussion, you make those plays.
I mean,
you got to make that play, Jamal Adams, when it hits you right in the stomach. Mm-hmm. You know, Uamadi, you got to make that catch. KJ, you got to find a way. KJ probably had three or four opportunities. And that last thing I'm going to do is rip KJ because he had the best year, I thought, on the defense, you know, outside of maybe Jamal Adams. But, you know, yeah, so you're right, though. It's a great question because you can much more control the giveaways, like ball security. Don't take shots deep. Don't be reckless with the ball. Don't, you know, throw it into coverage, things like that. But on defense, it's about opportunities that you have to take advantage of, you know, and you got to be trying to punch the ball out. You're trying to obviously play tight coverage, but I feel like it's a little bit more difficult. Like you can't tell a team, hey, we're going to be really good at taking the ball away this year.
Yeah.
Okay.
That,
well,
that's our focus. We're going to go ahead and do that.
Yeah. Because other teams are going to try to keep it. So
we're going to go ahead and start taking the ball away. We've decided.
Right. But I mean, it was really bad with the, you know, I mean, compared to most Pete Carroll teams, this is the second worst performance. You know, 2016, you know, they gave the ball up 18 times, but they only got 19 takeaways. But other than that, this is the second worst year, including, you know, the last time they had this few takeaways was 2017. That year was dreadful.
So the issue for you is not that they were giving the ball up too much, turning it over. I mean, yeah, you don't want to turn it over, but it wasn't any more than what they had done in previous seasons. But it was more about what the defense wasn't capitalizing on.
Right.
The opportunities they were getting, they weren't turning into a possession, taking a possession away from the opposition. And whether, I mean, there's still value to it. People argue, well, the offense just comes out there and goes three and out, and who cares? It's not that big a deal. You're still taking away a scoring opportunity from the opposition, especially when your defense for a good part of the season was playing so poorly. Great opportunity to get them off the field.
Right.
Right? Take away a possession, limit the scoring opportunities for the opposition, and give your offense a chance, who at the beginning of the year, first nine game, whatever, were on fire.
Right.
So those it makes those even more crucial, in my opinion, based on the way the defense was playing.
Yeah. So, I mean, and so did he overreact? And the other question would be, would he have gone in and said anything if they had been taking the ball away at the rate that they have been? Because he'd be like, hey, my turnover ratio is still intact here.
Yeah.
Yes, we're giving it up a few extra times. But again, I mean, they finished with 18. That's about normal for them. So, you know, and the question is whether or not that, you know, helped them. But I'll tell you what, focusing on giveaways and not turning the ball over is what really, really good teams do. You look at 2019. This year it was a little bit deceiving because for some reason the Chargers were in there, which says a lot about Justin Herbert.
Yeah, for a rookie quarterback.
Yeah, he had the last four games they won, he threw eight touchdowns and one interception. So,
wow.
But, you know, he was 6-9 on the year. But they made it in there. But Green Bay had 11. Tennessee had 12 giveaways, Indianapolis 15, Kansas City 16, and then the Chargers had 16 as well. So they were kind of a – but, I mean, you look at 2019, New Orleans 12-4, Green Bay 12-4, New England or KC 14-2, 13-3, 13-3. I mean, we're talking about 800 win percentage if you're top five in giveaways, meaning you hold on to the ball. It's hugely important. So I understand why Pete – you know, is totally emphasizing that because it's always the most indicative stat other than, you know, points scored and wins and losses.
All right, coming up, the Rams and 49ers are now facing quarterback questions and a lot of turnover on their coaching staff. So is this an opportunity for the Seahawks to set themselves apart from the rest of the NFC West? Talk about that next with Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Dave Wyman and Bob Stelton.
One took it the way they should, the other one did not, Dave. That's how that story ended.
Thank you.
As we tell stories off the
air. Can only imagine what that was about.
It is Wyman and Bob here on 710 ESPN Seattle. So the Rams, as we learned past couple of days, have some turmoil with their quarterback position and their head coach, right? Jared Goff, Sean McVay, according to Steve Wyche and others. There's a little hard feelings there. Or still hard to figure out exactly what it's about.
Right when I start to like Jared Goff.
I know. He finally earned your respect, and now they're like, we're not sure about our quarterback.
Well, it was interesting because we looked at 78% completion percentage there. I'm sure Sean McVay is not just look, the coaches, analysts, whatever, they don't look at the stats.
Yeah.
They look at the film. They look at what, you know, and maybe Jared Goff missed a bunch of throws there. I don't know. It's because I don't know how you could properly judge him based on the last few weeks. He's had his thumb surgically repaired.
Yeah, if anything, so you think that would if there were open wounds, you know, I'm just throwing that out there, not literally, but that would sort of heal it if there was a rift.
Yeah.
You know, hey, this guy's gutting it out, man. He can barely hold the ball. He clearly can't throw a spiral, but he's out there gutting it out. And, you know, they ran a quarterback sneak with him, you know, and I'm thinking, wow. And then he got out there the next week, and we were, according to John Clayton, he didn't want him to play. I'm thinking, did he not want him to play because he doesn't believe in him, or he just didn't want to re-injure it or didn't think he was going to be effective enough because of the thumb? So anyway, you've got turmoil there, and then we're hearing that 49ers aren't completely committed to Jimmy G either. So you've got what feels like two uncertain situations at the most important spot on the roster. And
both losing their defensive coordinators.
Yeah, losing coordinators. So this feels like, you know, and depending on who they bring in to, as far as coordinators and all of that, but Seahawks won the division this year. We thought it would be between them and the 49ers before the 49ers suffered all those injuries. Now it feels like the Seahawks have a real opportunity to capitalize on the turmoil that exists with those other two teams, and that's, again, not losing sight of the Cardinals and Kyler Murray. They certainly could take another big step this upcoming season and be in the thick of it. But, man, the two teams, especially the Rams, who just give you so many problems, as we've talked about, seeing them have some level of distress at the most important position is kind of nice.
Yeah.
Kind of nice, and an opportunity for the Seahawks if they bring in the right offensive coordinator not named Adam Gase.
Well, let's make sure that's clear. Well, if you're down there, are you thinking, yeah, we lost these guys, and yeah, maybe our quarterback situation isn't that great, but they don't have an offensive coordinator up there, and you know it looks like Russell Wilson's maybe not as advertised. And maybe he's not that good. I mean,
I think they're lying to themselves if they say that.
Trying to make themselves feel better. I mean, I don't know. I mean, Jared Goff's been to the Super Bowl in the last 3 years, so maybe that's, you know, something that they think that, well, maybe Russ, you know, what was it? I was listening to Stacey and Jake that, like, there was like a list of, I shouldn't even have brought it up. it was like a list of five.
Editing on the fly here.
Yeah, you know, Mara can't even put this information in my head right now. But yeah, it was having to do with the last time they appeared in a conference championship.
Oh, the Seahawks?
The Seahawks, yeah. And there was just a short list of teams that have not done that.
Yeah, in the NFC. Yeah, it was like the Giants, Washington, Seahawks. Yeah, I saw the list yesterday. Right. I can't remember what made it feel bad is it was a bunch of teams that were just kind of historically bad, right. And then the Seahawks.
And the Seahawks.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I mean maybe you're looking at it that way, but I mean that's kind of interesting to think, you know, that they may be thinking that way about the Seahawks, but what about Arizona? You know, I mean that's the other team to look at, and they've got the young coach and they got the young mobile quarterback there, and they've got some pretty good pieces on defense, but yeah, it was just a weird year. And like the Rams losing to San Francisco twice, so I mean it's if you're down there, I'm thinking you're probably not feeling too good, especially since Goff was not too long ago this big franchise quarterback. I mean, what, second pick in the draft or first? I'm trying to remember which one. I know that Wentz and him went 1 and 2,
and they re-signed him. By the way, I've got the list here. It was a back and forth between the Hawk blogger and Rob Staten.
Yeah, Staten, our guy from England.
Yeah, it was a back and forth between them because Hawk blogger said since 2015, he's saying people say the Seahawks have done nothing since the Super Bowl years. So he wrote since 2015 wins, second best in the NFC, playoff wins, tied for third in the NFC, playoff appearances, first in the NFC, division titles, tied for first in the NFC West, never lower than second. Point differential, second in the NFC, all since 2015. Rob countered with, also since 2015, here's a list of teams not to play in the NFC Championship game. Washington, the Giants, Dallas, Detroit, Chicago, Seattle.
Wow. That's hard to believe.
It is. Everyone else has been there.
Yeah. I was just thinking, like, in our own division, yeah, Arizona went, and who did they lose to? The Packers?
Yeah, I can't remember. Yeah, it's just...
Yeah, I mean, so it's... No, they lost to the Panthers. They lost
was that
to
who
Arizona
it was?
Yeah, did. Yeah, and that was the year that the Panthers, you know, jumped out to that 31-0 lead or whatever it was. But
that's not good company.
That is bad company. That's bad company. I would have never, you know, guessed that. But it just because, look, the stat I always go with is... I know this. It's hard to make it into the playoffs. And, you know, I was lucky and got to here in a time when they were really starting to roll with Chuck Knox and 86, you know, that they were, I think they were 10-6. They were like the hottest team in the NFL at the end of the season, didn't make the playoffs. 87 made a wild card appearance, 88 won the division. And then after that, that was it. And then I, you know, when I got to the Broncos, it was coming off of, you know, it was that first year that Wade Phillips was there, Elway, you know, they got a bunch of free agents in there, and we went lost in the first round. But it's just, it's hard to make it to the playoffs. And so I'm always quoting the, hey, 9 out of 11 times John and Pete have put together a team to get them into the playoffs. That's really hard to do. But, you know, going and look, fans are going to complain. I mean, who would you rather be? I mean, would you rather be like Detroit or
no?
You know, I mean, that's the thing that I think we're a little bit spoiled, I guess, is my point. But I understand. I mean, with Russell and having a franchise quarterback and the money that you're spending on him and some of your defensive players, you're spending that and making the trades like for Jamal Adams. You're spending that to get to
creates it raises the expectation, right? Where just making it to the playoffs isn't good enough. Once you get there, you've got to do something, and they haven't gotten past the divisional round since 2014. So it's just, I get it. I get it, because you feel like every year you got a chance, and they have this double-digit win regular season, and this year 12 wins, and every year you could point to, yeah, that team wasn't very good, they should beat them, or yeah, they got lucky in this game. Every year, it doesn't matter. You had those games, I'm sure we'd go back through the schedule in 13 and go, yeah, they probably got lucky to win this game here, or, you know, yeah, this game they didn't play well, but they pulled out a win. I mean, style points don't mean a ton if you're getting the Super Bowl, but they're not getting there. That's the problem. So we get all hyped up. We look at the record and say, man, they're built for it. They're ready for it this year. And then they get knocked out in the wild card round, or they get knocked out in the divisional round. And you're just like, man, we're in the same spot every single year, despite the additions, despite the money that's being spent on individuals. I get the frustration. I mean, I spoiled on one hand, but at the same time, when you put $35 million a year into your quarterback and $18 million into your middle linebacker, and you just re-signed your GM and just re-signed your head coach, and you feel like you've got some level of stability, shouldn't there be more to achieve there? Shouldn't the expectation, is it fair to have a higher expectation?
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, there's, well, I don't know about 31 other NFL cities where you're having this discussion, because I'm sure the Jets and Jacksonville aren't expecting that anytime soon. But, I mean, you look at the teams that are competing and that are in, you know, Arizona, the Rams, San Francisco, Dallas, certainly. I mean, they're all trying to do the same thing. It's incredibly difficult, and I'm just going to stick with it because, you know, it's true. Everybody's trying to get to that level, and it's just so hard to do. And you see the New England Patriots doing it, you know, and maybe that's what I was listening to Stacey and Jake was saying, you know, look, Mahomes is really the only guy right now that's on a track to be kind of a Tom
Brady-like
guy that takes his team every year practically. So it's just really difficult to do.
All right, we'll come back. We'll talk some more football with a professor. He'll join us next year with Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.